to be looking at a text this morning from Matthew chapter 7. We are finishing up our series from the Sermon on the Mount this morning. And this is as Jesus kind of draws to the conclusion of this sermon, he makes a pretty strong statement here about eternity. And we've pointed out that throughout this sermon, there have been parallels between this is what the Pharisees do, but this is what I'm telling you to do. And we even pointed out in a couple of the messages, you hear Jesus say, you have heard this, but I say this. And so that's kind of been a theme throughout the Sermon on the Mount. Here's what the Pharisees do. Here's what I'm telling you to do. And so Jesus, near the conclusion of this, says these words. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. And there are few who find it. Okay. Now, when you look at that text, and clearly here Jesus is essentially talking about, you know, the way the Pharisees are telling you to go, that is the wide gate, okay? That is the wide gate. I'm telling you about a much more narrow gate and a narrow path. This is almost prophetic in how we live in a world now where everybody thinks the path to heaven is just wide open. There are actually plenty of churches that teach everybody's going, everybody's getting in. You know, if you just mean well, if you try hard, you know, I guess this kind of grows from the generation of everybody gets a trophy. And some of you are probably sitting there going, oh, I knew he was going to say that. And you know me well. When I was a kid, the first place kids got a trophy. And the second place kids got to watch the first place kids get a trophy. And our coach would tell us, you want a trophy? Yeah. Win next year. That's what our coach used to tell us. Now, I realize some of you in here are going, you're mean. And I am. This is the product of how I was raised. This is what happens when you're a kid and you don't get a trophy. You grow up to be an angry old man like me. But we live in this culture now where we never like to say anybody's wrong, and we don't want to say anybody's not on the right path because that's offensive and it hurts people's feelings. I have contended for years that what really should hurt someone's feelings is that they get to stand before God and he says, I don't know you, see ya. And then that person's like, why didn't one of my friends tell me? That's what should hurt your feelings. If you end up going to hell because nobody told you better, that should hurt your feelings. Somebody trying to tell you the right way to get there shouldn't hurt your feelings. But if somebody doesn't tell you, I would think that would hurt my feelings. If Jesus told me on Judgment Day, I'm sorry, hell's over there, enjoy yourself. And I'm like, what did I do wrong? Oh, a bunch of stuff. You had a bunch of friends that knew. Well, none of them ever told me. Well, I'll talk to them about that when they get here. I'd be pretty upset about that. So Jesus is drawing this comparison between the Pharisees and between the teachings that he is giving. He says, look, my way's harder. It's more complicated. It takes more effort. And that's funny because the Pharisees said you need to follow the law. And so that was kind of their thing. Now we're going to get into kind of more detail about what the issue is with this text as we get into the next few verses. But it is important to know that we do still live in an era where the gate is narrow. And that hasn't changed. Even though the world tells us that the gate isn't narrow anymore. In fact, over time, the gate seems to get wider and wider and wider. But Jesus says, no, that's not true. The gate is still narrow. The path is still small. This is not an easy path to walk. He said, and the truth is that wide gate, a lot of people are going to go through that gate because it's the easy gate. It's the simple path. How many of you have ever chosen the simple path instead of the correct path? Any of you ever done that? It's always funny. It's like you'll get instructions sometimes, and there'll be like 43 steps. And those of us who are smart enough, we'll condense that down to like 6. And we'll skip several steps because, oh, nobody does that. You ever done that? And then you got finished and you realized, I think I missed something important. I feel like I missed something important. And what we've done is we've taken what my father used to call it, the path of least resistance. Any of you ever taken the path of least resistance? You know, if I go that way, there's going to be resistance. I'm going to get pushed back on stuff. But the easiest thing to do is just do this. And let's be honest. All of us have had a point in our life where we just thought, I don't need the hassle. I don't need the hassle. The path of least resistance is the way I'm going because I don't need the hassle. And I know if I go this way, I'm going to have to deal with stuff, and I don't want to deal with stuff. So all that stuff being said, Jesus says there's a narrow gate, there's a wide gate. Let's get on to verse 15. And then Jesus gets into how this wide gate versus small gate gets taught. He says, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. And then I love this analogy. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad trees bear bad fruit. Now, I'm gonna stop right there. I want to go back to verse 15. Beware the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. I was telling Joey this morning, I got online yesterday because I've had COVID now, a full dose of it, thank you very much. And so I was thinking, okay, at some point, maybe I'll want to get the shot. I don't call it a vaccine because technically it's not a vaccine. It's a shot. You get the shot. So I was like, at some point I might want to get the shot. So I thought, now what I need to do now is find out how long I have to wait to get the shot if I decide to get it after I've had COVID. So I found two websites who had the answer. One said 10 days, one said 6 months. And neither had the "this is fake news, false information" stamp of Zuckerberg or Bill Gates. And since the Google can't lie, the answer is 6 months and 10 days. That's the only thing I can assume, is that you just have to add the two together. That's where I'm at right now. It's the only thing I can think of, because neither one can be wrong. So you just add them together. I don't know. Now, the truth is, a lot of us have accumulated information over the years that's well-intentioned if it's not correct. One of my favorites. My mother was a fountain of knowledge. And my wife was certain that most of that knowledge was wrong. So Stephanie has this interesting habit. Stephanie pops her knuckles. Belinda, is that amusing to you? Stephanie pops her knuckles. Now, I've never been a knuckle popper, but Stephanie pops her knuckles. So one day we're sitting in the house and she's popping her knuckles. I said, "You should stop that. That's going to give you arthritis." And she said, "That's stupid. Who told you that?" I said, "Mama." Well, now it's on. Because now she has just told me that information that came directly from the Fran was incorrect. Any of you ever heard popping your knuckles gives you arthritis? Is it true? No. Now, it's funny. Somebody just went no, and the person beside them looked at them like, "Mom says it is." We could go through, I mean, look, let's be honest. We could spend the rest of the morning going through home remedies for every ailment in the world. Pam Jolly, who's not here this morning, she's got some tests tomorrow, so she's not here today. Pam, anytime I used to get like a sinus thing, she would tell me, you need to take echinacea. I didn't know what that was. And so I told somebody, I said, this lady at my church says I should take echinacea. No, you should take vitamin D. By the way, you'd be amazed how many people in this very room actually know the cure for COVID. And you know how I know that? Because when I got COVID, you all shared with me. Stuart, this is what you should be doing. Some of them, you know, were like, take all these. It was like vitamin B and D and C and A. I was like, just the whole alphabet of vitamins. Take some zinc. I got zinc was in there. Echinacea. Stuart, take echinacea, which I'm still not sure what that is. And everybody, you should drink this and take that. I got a lot of good advice. I really didn't follow any of it, but I got a lot of good advice. We understand, and when that information comes to us, it's not normally poorly intended. I mean, people don't mean to tell you the wrong thing. They just tell you what they've heard and what they think has worked for them. And so they share that information. Well, you think about what people think about God and eternity and salvation and all those things, and you start asking yourself a question. Where does this information come from? Where does it come from? Does anybody know how many Muslims are in the world today? Ballpark? Anybody know how many? There's just to tell you, I think the latest estimate, we're close to 8 billion people on Earth now. Close to 8 billion. I would say probably if you took the numbers, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion. Probably 1.5 billion Muslims. Why are there 1.5 billion Muslims? Because 1,400 years ago, this guy named Muhammad claimed to be a prophet. He claimed to be a prophet. And he convinced people that he was a prophet. And he gave them a list of rules and instructions, and eventually came the Quran. And now there are 1.5 billion people in this world who believe Jesus was a prophet but don't believe he was the Son of God. And you know why they don't believe that? Because Muhammad came to them as a false prophet, a new teaching. And there's been a long list of false prophets. Joseph Smith. I probably made somebody mad. That's okay. Don't be mad. Just be right. False prophet. Hey, look, I got this new set of rules. I got this golden thing that came out of the sky, and it's got a whole new thing. Why do we need a new thing? What's wrong with the thing? What's wrong with Jesus? And there are millions of people who have followed that prophet. Now, I can't speak to Muhammad's intention. I can't speak to Joseph Smith's intention. I can't speak to David Koresh's intention. I can't speak to Jim Jones's intention. I can't speak to the intent of any false prophet because I don't know them personally. But here's what I can tell you. The people that follow them are on the wrong path. They're on the wrong path. And some people say, well, sir, you shouldn't say that. Somebody better tell them. Somebody better say it. And why are they on the wrong path? Because they're following a different prophet. And Jesus says, look, it's going to come. Beware of the false prophets. They're going to come. And they're going to come in sheep's clothing. But inside, they're ravenous wolves. And you'll know them by their fruits. Now, one of the things that I find fascinating about the fruit analogy is that Jesus talks about the difference in bearing good fruit and bad fruit. Now, here's the problem. To identify a false prophet, you have to identify their fruits, right? Now, here's the question. How many of you know the difference in good fruit and bad fruit? Now, some of you are going, this feels like a trick question. Is philanthropy, is helping the poor good fruit or bad fruit? That was very pensive. How many of you think helping the poor is good fruit? Okay, so guess who that would make the greatest person on earth right now? Bill Gates. Bill Gates gives more money to charity every year than any person in the world. How many of you think that Bill Gates is a good prophet? Now, if you just say, well, Stuart, giving to the poor is good fruit, therefore, he's bearing good fruit, therefore, I should listen to what he says. How many of you think that makes sense? What, Jim? It makes sense, right? It makes sense if our only criteria for giving to the poor is that's good fruit. Let me ask you a question. Can atheists give to the poor? Can evil people give to the poor? Sure. So what does that tell us about giving to the poor? In and of itself, it is not necessarily good fruit. And see, what we've done is we've taken our definition of good fruit and bad fruit, and it generally has nothing to do with God, right? It has to do with social issues. We have become a culture that identifies good fruit not necessarily by what it produces, but by the intent. So let's say some person came up to you who clearly had a drinking problem. Let's say they caught you in the churchyard after church. And, I mean, you could smell it on them, and you could look at them and tell, and they said, I need 20 bucks. And you went, oh, I feel bad for this person. Now, you know when you hand them the 20 bucks, what that 20 bucks is probably going to purchase, right? So is giving that person 20 bucks good fruit? Now, see, we might sit there and go, well, okay, according to the Bible, I'm giving a needy person money. So this is good fruit, right? But if you know what they're going to do with that money, you know they're going right across the street and they're getting ready to invest $20 in Mad Dog 2020. Now, some of you are going, what's that?
That's a lot of Mad Dog.
That's a lot of Mad Dog. I thought, that's a Mad Dog? Maybe pick up, I'm going old school here. Maybe pick up a little Boone's Farm. Yeah, a little Strawberry Pink Boone's Farm, you know? So, some of you are laughing because you're like, I remember drinking that in high school. You get a lot of that for $20 too. Now, if you know that's what they're going to do with it, are you bearing good fruit and giving them that money? Now, what would be better is if you said, hey, I tell you what, look, I'm not giving you cash, but I'll be happy to drive to McDonald's and buy you lunch. I'll buy you some food. And even though there's a good chance that McDonald's food is worse for you than Mad Dog 2020, it's a different kind of bad, so it's, you know, at least it's sustenance, and you know, cholesterol is probably not your biggest concern right now, so I'm going to take you and get you some lunch. That would probably be better fruit. But here's the thing, which one is easier to do? Well, if I just hand that dude 20 bucks, he's out of my hair. I feel like I've done something good. And what he does with it from here isn't really my problem. Whereas if I'm going to take him to get lunch, now I got to get him in my car. And I got to drive him someplace. That's going to take more time. And then if he's with me in the car and we're in the drive-thru and the drive-thru's locked, now he wants to talk to me and I got to tell you. It's so much easier, right? It's just so much easier just to give him $20. And so we understand that one of the things that's critical in judging someone by their fruit is first being able to identify the difference in good fruit and bad fruit. And sometimes that's hard. It's not always clear. And so there are things that we might on the surface go, that seems like good fruit. Later you go, well, maybe that wasn't good fruit. Maybe it looked like good fruit. You know what that reminds me of? Remember Adam and Eve? It says, when Eve saw the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, what did she say about it? That looks like good fruit. It looked good to eat. What was the problem? God told him, there's one fruit in the garden you are not to eat. Do not eat that fruit. It looked like good fruit. Probably smelled like good fruit. It was very, very pleasing to the eye, probably to the nose. And they're like, man, I want to try this. But the problem is it wasn't good fruit for them because they've been told not to eat it. So Jesus, one of the things Jesus challenges the people to do is, look, you've got to identify prophets by their fruit. And so the first thing you have to do is identify if the fruit is good or not. So somebody came up to me one day and said, Stuart, I was watching Oprah this week. And I said, stop. Stop. Just stop it. But they said, I was watching Oprah this week, and Oprah said that anyone of faith is going to heaven. I went, uh-huh. I was like, is there a question coming? Or they said, what do you think about that? I said, I would check into Oprah's credentials, see where she got her theology degree. Now, why would Oprah say that? Wait, what? Ratings. Oprah wants people to watch her show. Oprah wants people to like her. Because people don't like Oprah, don't watch Oprah. And the more people that watch Oprah, the more money Oprah makes. What qualifies Oprah to tell you that everybody's in? Because that sounds good. It feels good. I'm fixing. I promised I wouldn't do this, but I lied. Do you know why Joel Osteen has such a big church and he's so popular and everybody buys his books? Because you know why? Because when you read his book, you're good. You're fine. He has a huge following because he never tells anybody that anything they're doing is wrong. That makes you very popular. When you tell people, hey, you know what? You really need to do better. You got some things in your life you need to clean up. You got some behaviors you need to fix. You've got some attitudes that need to be adjusted. You need to do this and this and this better. People go, I don't like that guy. How many of you love being corrected? Not a hand. If you're at home watching and you're wondering, Stuart, how many hands went up? None. Who said that? You like being corrected when you're wrong? Okay, so Dale is the only one. Because I'll go ahead and tell you, I don't ever like being corrected. And if you don't believe that, feel free this afternoon to call my father and ask him, did Stuart like being corrected when he was growing up? You can call any of my teachers, go back to my professors in college, people that know me now. Stuart, you're wrong. Shut up. None of us like being corrected. None of us like being told that we're wrong. And so sometimes the fruit of a good prophet actually doesn't taste very good, does it? Sometimes the good fruit of correction, yeah, it tastes very good. It tastes bitter, right? When someone corrects you, someone says, hey, you need to do better. And so we need to do a better job of judging fruit and what is good fruit and what is not good fruit. He says, a good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. He says, every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So all the trees aren't getting in. So then you will know them by their fruits. So the challenge Jesus is putting out here is he says, you've got to do a better job of judging if the fruit is good or not. Because sometimes things bear fruit that aren't good for us, that aren't healthy, looks good. I marvel sometimes at trying to figure out how people decided what was good to eat and what's not. I mean, who looked at a pineapple and said, I bet there's some good stuff in there? I mean, you look at a pineapple, if you see one out in the wild, a wild pineapple, if you see a wild pineapple, you look at that thing and go, I ain't touching that. It's prickly and it could hurt me. It's got armor. It occurred to somebody to cut that thing open and see what was in there. And tasty goodness was in there. I love some pineapple, especially on pizza. No judgment. Bacon and ham and pineapple is a tasty, tasty pizza. You're welcome to disagree. You're welcome to be wrong. Coconut. Now, I'm not an aficionado of coconut. I don't like coconut. It's a texture issue for me. But it occurred to somebody to crack that thing open. And, oh, look, there's something good in here. I don't know. I'm told that wilderness survival people, to figure out if something is safe to eat or not, they watch the wild animals. The wild animals generally stay away from poisonous things. Do you know that there is fruit in nature that's poisonous and dangerous? Who knew? Who knew? The animals knew. And so Jesus here is kind of laying out for us. You've got to be able to judge the fruit. Don't just judge it on its surface. You've got to take a solid look at it. You've got to use some discernment because false prophets sometimes put out fruit that looks good. It looks tasty. Did you ever wonder how David Koresh got those people to go in that compound with him? Fruit. Jim Jones. Most of you are old enough to remember Jim Jones. How did they get people to follow him? Because people were not judging the fruit that they were producing. They took a quick glance, liked what they were hearing, but they didn't look deeper, and they did not judge the quality of the fruit that was being produced. So Jesus here gives us a stern warning about this. Beware the fruit. Pay attention. All right, next verse, please. Verse 21. This should be, if you don't take anything else home from today, this you should take home with you. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. That's kind of shocking, isn't it? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Now, I want you to take a minute and think about the weight of what Jesus is telling the crowd as they're standing there, as he kind of winds down to the end of this sermon. And think about what the implication is for you as an individual. Jesus says, listen, there are going to be a lot of people who say, Lord, I've done all these things in your name. And he says, not everyone who says that is going to get in. Now, in popular culture, we've got people out there saying, oh, they're going to get in, and they're going to get in, and all you have to be is well-intentioned to get in. Let me ask you a question. What is the criteria that Jesus identifies to get in? He says, let's see. The will of my Father, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Now, if that's true, what would that presuppose you must know to be sure you're going to heaven? The will of the Father, right? So if I ask you today, what's the will of the Father? How many of you would feel really comfortable that you know the answer? That's a great question. What is the will of the Father? Does he mean the will of the Father in general or the will of the Father for me? How many of you have ever wrestled with the question, what does God want me to do? What is his will for me? Now, if knowing and doing his will are a necessary component of salvation, and you're sitting there going, I don't really know what his will is. I've never really thought about it. I just like to go to church and worship. If Jesus was preaching the Sermon on the Mount today, I like to think that one of the things he would say, not everyone that says, Lord, Lord, will in the kingdom of heaven. But many will say, Lord, did we not worship in your name? Because that's the big thing now, right? I want to go worship. I want to go worship. I love the music, and I love that band is so good, and they've got so much good music, and they've got that smoke machine which produce smoke directly from heaven. And they've got a great light show, and the singers are so good, and the musicians are so talented, and I so enjoy the worship. And for the next 7 days, I'm not going to do anything that has anything to do with God's will, but I'll be back next Sunday to worship. Do you know how, I mean, can you even begin to guess how many worshipers are going to stand before the Lord one day and go, you didn't do anything I told you to do. You didn't follow the Father's will at all. What do you mean? I sang for an hour a week. What more could you want from me? Does the absurdity of that question sink into you at all? We sang for an hour a week. What more could you want from me? How about you do my will? Your what? Do my will. Your will? I thought your will was me going and singing. Jesus says, look, guys, it's important you know this. For the people in this room today, it is important that you hear this and understand the warning that Jesus lays out. Not everybody who stands and goes, hey, you know how much I went to church? Do you know how much I went to church? Do you know how many times, you know how many times I stood at the door and welcomed people? Do you know how many times I did this? You know how many times I did that? Now, I want to end this morning by focusing on this last sentence. In verse 23, he says, then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Now, a lot of times when people look at verse 23, the part they focus on is depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. But I want to focus on this statement, I never knew you. Now, when Jesus came to earth to live among us, to die for us, what was already in place? The law, the Mosaic law, okay? This incredibly comprehensive list of rules. Of things to do, of things not to do. Now, I, for years, I have heard people identify this as a rule book. This is not a rule book. Okay? This is a book that has some rules in it, but it's not a rule book. If Jesus and God had been content with a rule book, then what would they have used? The one that was already there. We've already got the Mosaic Law. We've already got a rule book. We've got a rule book in place. So Jesus didn't come to edit the rule book. That's not why he came. So why did he come? Why did Jesus come? He says, I didn't come to abolish the law. What did I come to do? I came to fulfill it. And then Paul spends the next 30, 40 years trying to tell people, you're not under the law anymore. You're now under grace. You're not under the law, okay? You don't have to, you're not under the law anymore. But when it comes right down to it, this phrase is really telling. Who is Jesus going to turn away from him on Judgment Day? What does he say? Who's he going to turn away? No, no, no. The part before that. Remember, I just said, that's not the important verse. What's the important verse? I never knew you. So who's he going to turn away? People he doesn't know. People he doesn't know. Now, let's take a minute, because some of you, I can see some of the wheels turning right now. Jesus is omnipotent. He knows everybody. So what's he saying here? Why did Jesus come and die? He came to die to fix a problem. What was the problem he came to fix? That in the garden, Adam and Eve sinned, and in that sin, what did they create? A separation from God. They create a separation. The relationship between God and man was broken in the garden. Remember, God used to come down and walk in the garden with Adam and Eve. Used to fellowship with them, used to hang out with them, used to spend time with them. Why did God create man in the first place? Companionship. He didn't just want angels. He created man in what? His own image. Somebody like him. I don't think we do a great job in church sometimes in really defining what it means to be created in God's image. That doesn't mean that God has two arms and two legs. We are created like him so that we could be in fellowship with him. We were created to be in relationship with him. And Adam and Eve broke that in the garden, and Christ came to restore it. By his sacrifice of atonement, we were able to re-enter relationship with God in a way that had not been available since the garden. Now, take all that we just said and look at who doesn't get in. I don't know you. I sent my son to die so that we could know each other. And until you have stood before me today, you have rejected my relationship. You've rejected my love. You've rejected my fellowship. You've rejected my atonement, my forgiveness. You've rejected all of it because you didn't want a relationship with me. And God says, on judgment day, the people I'm going to turn away aren't the people who weren't good enough, not the people who did this or did that. He says, I'm going to turn away the people I don't know. So what does that mean? It means it doesn't matter if you go to church every Sunday if you're not in a relationship with Jesus. You can't put enough money in the plate to buy your way in. You can't show up enough. You can't get perfect attendance, and perfect attendance is going to get me in. You can't be good enough because that's impossible. There is one method by which we can stand before God and not hear, "Depart from me, because I don't know you." And it's so easy. It's right in front of our face. What's the solution? How do we not hear that? Know him. That's it. And how do you know him? How do you get to know somebody? Well, generally, if you want to get to know somebody, you spend time with them, right? And by the way, it's not all the time you spend talking. Sometimes it's time you spend listening. And you're like, well, you know what? He doesn't really say much to me. Well, how about his word? That thing that we call a rule book is not a rule book. It's a developmental guide for having a relationship with God. It tells us about his nature and who he is and what he's looking for in a relationship. So that when we stand in front of him one day, he doesn't go, "I don't know you. I don't know you." Any of you ever spent time around somebody and then later on you realize you didn't know them? I've been to funerals before where I've sat there and heard people talk about someone and go, "I didn't know that about them. I didn't know that about them. I didn't know that. I didn't know they liked it." And then I realized, you know what? I really didn't know this person. Has that ever happened to any of you? Where you enter into some sort of superficial relationship with somebody, and it's like we joke about the difference in a friend and an acquaintance. You know, it's like these people that we sort of know, but we don't really know. And if somebody says, "Well, we're friends on Facebook," so as we look at what Jesus is doing here, he says, "Look, what I've come to do." We had the law, and the Pharisees follow that. But see, here's the problem. That path leads to destruction. Just following the rules. You just think about hearing, you hear somebody say that and you go, "What? Following the rules is the path to destruction?" It is if there's no relationship. See, the irony is when you develop a relationship with God, you know the rules to follow and the ones that you know what's important. But all that comes from a relationship. And over the years, you know what I've found? A lot of people develop a relationship with the church, or they develop relationship with the ministry staff, or they develop relationship with the programs, or they develop relationship with the people. But somewhere in all that, they never developed a relationship with God. There's no relationship there with Him. All the relationships are around Him, but they're not Him. And that's why He says, look, not everybody that says to me, Lord, Lord, is going to be saved, because there are going to be a lot of people that claim a relationship with me that don't really have one. And we've jumped through the right hoops, and we've gone through all the right steps, and we followed the program, but we've really never bothered to develop a relationship with God. And guys, He didn't send Jesus to die for you so you could go to church and sing. You know how I know that? Because He's got a heaven full of angels that sing better than you. If all He wanted was a concert, He had angels. And I'm not saying He doesn't like worship. I'm not saying He doesn't appreciate worship. Here's what I'm saying. Worship minus relationship is nothing. I'm going to close with this morning. The prophet Isaiah, when prophesying to the children of Israel, said this: these people, they honor me with their lips. Anybody know how that next verse ends? How that verse ends? But their hearts are far from me. The praise team is going to come and lead us in our communion song this morning. Here's the question I want to leave you with today. And it's a simple question, and it's a personal question. If you stood before God today, and you think about all the time you've spent at church, and all the things you've done, and all the hoops you've jumped through, and all the fruit that you've bared, at the end of the resume, would Jesus look at you and say, I know you. I know you. Because you developed a relationship with me. And because I know you, come on in. Or would He look at you and go, I know all the stuff you did, but I don't know you. I don't know you. You never developed a relationship with me. You never talked to me. You never spent time with me. You never loved me. You loved a lot of stuff that I provided, but there was never anything between you and I. Which one of those things would you hear if your time came today?